At 6:30, when our class is over, there's going to be a reception in 331 down the hall. It's in honor of Nora, who's, you know, resigning here and going to go to Temple to be an assistant professor there. So there's a little reception, drinks, foody thing sort of stuff. So we'll finish in time. So just if you want to linger and go down the hall afterwards, we're going to have a little something there so you can say goodbye to Nora and just mingle and stuff. Any questions right now about papers or anything that anybody needs to answer just right now in this forum? We can talk after class, anybody who wants to, too. That's fine, too. So today,
just email it to you?
The paper? Yeah, just email it to me, totally. So my email address that I've been using, just send it to me. So today, for the last class, we're talking about, this is in the board back there, seropositivity and disability protection, such that this semester we've been really starting historically thinking about the genesis of the virus, the epidemic, and sort of the way it culturally and epidemiologically was understood, and then went through a host of different issues the last few weeks or a couple of months to sort of see how the illness has been understood and how it's been discussed really culturally and historically and in different geographic contexts as well. Well, today what we're going to be doing is starting with watching a little bit of a short film. We started the class the first day by talking about some of the first pieces that show documentation of the virus in print and in culture and media from the New York Times and other places in the CDC. And then we also looked at a couple of short clips from the Frontline series on PBS about AIDS. Today I think it's appropriate we're going to end by watching the last installment of that Frontline series to bookend sort of that little exercise, but also because this last episode does a good job of taking us from what we talked about last week, international AIDS policy, and what we're talking about today, which is what is the future for AIDS in an era where chronicity or chronicness for the illness can happen, and yet the gravity of the issue still remains just as important. So we're going to watch a short film, about 20 minutes, about that to give us a brush up on sort of where we are now and talking about AIDS discourse globally and also civically, because that's very much what today is about. And then I'm going to direct us to just a couple of the readings that I had you guys do for today. The short article that was the newspaper report about when disability protections were extended to all persons with HIV, not just those with severe cases of full-blown AIDS. And we're going to look at some actual text that shows what are the rights that people have under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And I'm also going to give you a handout from the Human Rights Watch, which talks about what are the rights of individuals with disability and with HIV in the context of international policies related towards HIV and AIDS. The last thing we're going to do is take a look at that article that I put on there called Crip Eye for the Normate Guy. I'm sure some of you guys remember that show, Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. I mean, this article dates from that and is a riff on that. But it's basically trying to think about how do we render seropositivity, queerness, or any of these categories normal, or how do we render them disabled, or how do those terms get slippery or whatever. Basically, today's discussion is going to talk about the nature of disability protections, and then segue at the end towards what is called disability studies. I don't know if anybody is familiar with that, but this discipline that asks us to think about how can we think about identity and disability as actually being the same kind of conversation. So all of this under the rubric of this is the world we live in now with HIV and AIDS, which is people live with it, people still die from it, no one gets cured from it, and yet how do we discuss it and how far can we protect it, the identity itself in some way. So unless anybody has any questions, I'm going to start by just showing the short episode of the last episode from the Frontline series. As I said, it's going to feel like a nice recap of what we were talking about last week, a good summation of what we've sort of been discussing the last month or so, a good bookend for what we started with, and I think a good launching pad for what we're going to talk about today, which is about sort of disability protection.
In South Africa, the science of AIDS had been officially ignored for years.
It was very depressing for me because of seeing people dying of HIV and AIDS. Knowing that I'm HIV positive is very hard. It's really hard. I was very skinny. I was coughing all the time. I was getting weaker by the day. I was worried that if I die now, what's going to happen to my two sons? What am I going to do? Because I'll be dead. Who's going to take care of them?
Dorothy Mxalatiba checked into a nearby Catholic hospice where AIDS patients came to die.
Dorothy was very sick at some stage, and we were so scared that should Dorothy die, what about these children? The children will be orphans, and who is going to look well after these children?
South Africa was to be one of the biggest recipients of the global treatment programs. But President Thabo Mbeki had banned the triple cocktail. activist sued the government, forcing Mbeki's health minister to appear before the High Court.
The money had been allocated, the science was clear, the health profession was ready, the country was ready. The only obstacle was the Minister of Health and the President.
The court ruled unanimously that the government could not deny AIDS treatment to its citizens.
It broke the dam wall. It broke the dam wall in the sense that the country realized, A, that government's denialism is not invincible, and that people unified in action can achieve things.
Reluctantly, the government began to cooperate with the treatment programs. In late 2004, drugs from the Bush Fund arrived at this Catholic hospice, where one of the patients was Dorothy Maxalatiba.
One in the morning, one at night.
Okay. Then I began taking the drugs, and then I saw some improvement on my face, on my feet, and I was gaining weight. I've gained a lot of weight.
The wishes and the hopes started being realized. And I can just tell you from my own experience working in a rural, poor community. I mean, when we first started working there, our patients were dying, and there was nothing we could do. We just couldn't afford anything. And we now have all these patients on treatment, and now all you hear about is the patients who are suddenly gaining weight, going back to work, and they're encouraging others to get tested. It's changed the whole nature of the discourse.
But the vast majority of patients had to rely on state-run hospitals, where although the Global Fund paid for the cocktail, the health ministry set priorities.
This country only has 40,000 people on treatment. We have almost 5 million people that are HIV infected in South Africa. 40,000, that's like a drop in the ocean. You know, if we really are going to turn this epidemic around, we have to march out antiretroviral therapy. You know, we need a military operation, we need a state of emergency in this country.
Done exactly that when it promised treatment to every AIDS patient. But the drugs themselves had been a mixed blessing for the woman whose lawsuit had made antiretrovirals a human right.
Terrible. The effects were terrible. I used to think that the medication was going to kill me. There were 10 years of changing medication, getting ill, getting well, with several rare diseases. 10 years of health and illness and changing of medicine.
Nair Brito's difficulties showed up some of the limits of the drug therapy. Brazil was finding that patients on the cocktail lived, on average, an extra 8 years.
Today, the average survival time is most probably over 100 months. That definitely means that patients are now living longer, without being absent from work, without having to retire early, with quality of life, and with hope.
Brazil now spends a fifth of its health budget on AIDS.
Brazil is much better off than most developing countries. And the way I see it, the therapeutic option at times is only one. You have your frontline regimen, which is typically quite simple with three drugs, but there's no backup. So when you fail that frontline regimen, you have no other options.
I'm just praying that they can be available for the rest of my life.
I'm just praying that to be available until that time.
You believe they will be?
Yeah, I have to believe that, because if I don't believe that, then my health is going to go down back again.
KwaZulu-Natal, a nurse and a social worker take half a day to reach the home of Nkunzeni Ndwandwe. He once spent 6 years in the gold mines near Johannesburg and came home to die from AIDS. He now gets free drugs from the Bush plan. But both that plan and the Global Fund will run out of money in 2008.
I hope these leaders understand that when they make a commitment to a family, a man, woman, child with AIDS, that it's a long-term commitment. Because if budget cuts bite too hard, you will have the most preposterous sight of people being taken off antiretroviral drugs. If that happens, it will blow up. It will set fire to any good any of us have been working towards.
95% of all new infections are in poor countries. In the absence of aggressive prevention programs, it's estimated there will be at least 40 million more infections over the next decade. Treatment programs will never keep pace.
I still admire the compassion, I still commend the effort to treat, but we live in a world of limited resources. We have to bear in mind that during the years when this concerted treatment effort took place, approximately 2 million were treated, but during those years, another 15 million or so got newly infected.
What we've got here is a tortoise and a hare in which the tortoise will never catch the hare. The hare is the spread of AIDS. The tortoise is the slow-moving treatment programs. We have to attack HIV/AIDS as we've attacked every other infectious disease in the last century and a half. We have to attack it as it spreads, before it spreads.
Has over 5 million infections. A conservative country where sexual behavior is hidden, the virus has spread most quickly via sex workers and their male clients, like long-distance truckers.
Truckers tend to live away from home for a very long duration, you know, and there is no other source of recreation. So they tend to, work out that this is the only recreation that we have in life.
India's challenge is to get ahead of the disease now.
We don't want to go the way African countries have gone. Some of the countries, as you know, are completely, have lost their productive population. In case of India, where the infrastructure is also equally poor, to meet up with such kind of thing would be the saddest thing.
Back in 2000, the Clinton administration gave a 5-year grant to this project, which teaches safe sex to truckers.
ये आपको एक छल्ला लगा है लेकिन उस्ताद जी के लिए एक सवाल है तो उसमें एचआईवी का खतरा हो सकता है तो आइए ये जानकारी है
While on the road, many truckers have sex with other men.
जख्म हो सकते हैं, फट भी सकते हैं गुदा की जगह या लिंग के ऊपर ही उससे क्या होगा कि लिंग के खरोचों में से छोटी छोटी खून के बूंदे भी आने की संभावना दोनों में से अगर एक को भी एचआईवी तो एक से दूसरे के शरीर में एचआईवी प्रवेश कर सकता है ये लीजिए और ये ऐसा गोल मत कीजिएगा
बताया नहीं था अभी पता चला डॉक्टरों ने बताया
लोगों को क्या लगता है ये जो लक्षण है
In 2006, a major study showed that as a result of projects like this, infection rates among high-risk groups in South India had fallen by a third.
Our entire aim is that if we can reduce that incidence of HIV, it will be a big achievement for us.
project is unsure of its continuing funding. When it came up for renewal, the Bush administration gave it just a one-year extension. Nearby, in the world's largest red light district, another group found more secure money. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation pays retired sex workers to take prevention directly into the cramped brothels.
We don't take a moral stance because we don't think that that's an effective route to intervention. Commercial sex work has been there, will be there. There are factors that drive it. And our effort is to make commercial sex work safe. I've asked the question, why do you do this when your life's at risk? I've had a commercial sex worker tell me, look, I do it when my kids got a high fever and may not be alive tomorrow morning and I need the 50 rupees for milk or medicine. What's morality got to do with that? That's it's all about vulnerability. It's all about poverty. And that woman is doing it because she has to do it.
More and more we're seeing the face of HIV as a woman who may be monogamous and may even be married, who's at risk for HIV because of her husband's behavior. If we're serious about saving lives, we need to face the realities to meet people with options that are realistic for their life circumstances.
Major scientific effort could offer real hope for prevention. Researchers are developing a gel to kill the virus on contact. This microbicide would protect women whose partners refuse to wear a condom.
There are a variety of different ways in which a microbicide might actually work, but at the core of it, it would be a product that women could use that would protect themselves from HIV.
Of good things about microbicides if we can get one that works. Probably the most important of which is that it empowers women to be able to have a mechanism whereby they can protect themselves without their male partner knowing it would be very important.
Five microbicides are now in advanced clinical trials.
This is, after all, a disease that's 100% preventable. We're all in a race to get ahead of this thing. And it's a challenging endeavor because of the way the AIDS virus, in effect, invades the cell, reconfigures the DNA. I don't know if there'll be a cure in my lifetime, but I think there will be an effective vaccine.
Could one target these?
But the scientists who've devoted their lives to the study of the virus are cautious. A vaccine remains elusive.
There are 40-some million people with the virus at the moment. We know the rate of increase is approximately 5 million new cases per year. We still don't have a vaccine. We have drugs that are very helpful, but we don't have a cure.
With vaccine, we've really been stymied, and that is due to the very special nature of this virus. It's really unprecedented in what it can do, the rapidity with which it can multiply or replicate, how it can change.
Even if we come up with a cure or vaccine tomorrow, just think about the time that would be needed to implement all these measures widely throughout the world. So to me, it's clear that I'm not going to see the end of this epidemic. And it's also pretty clear that my children won't see the end of this epidemic. I think we won a few battles. I think most of the time HIV wins.
We're still putting ourselves at risk. I say ourselves, I'm an African-American woman. It's happening. We want to turn our backs and pretend it's not happening, but it is. It's happening every day. And there are people spreading it and not thinking anything of it.
The
younger generation don't know what an 80-pound purple-spotted man looks like. I mean, the visuals of AIDS in the 80s and early 90s were quite startling. We don't have that anymore. But there's also something that I'm seeing that's really, really disturbing. I'm seeing friends of mine who got on these drugs, did wonderfully. So now they want to be party kids, and they want to not use condoms anymore, and do crystal meth, and do all sorts of crazy drugs. And they're throwing it away. And that's really, really sad.
E principalmente o meu enfoque, ele foi de trabalho com mulher.
My focus now is to work with women.
E no seu cotidiano,
poor women who in their daily lives encounter violence and inequality.
Desigualdade. Isto somado,
all of this generates vulnerability.
Vulnerabilidade. Não há medicamentos que deem conta.
No medication can take care of hunger, physical violence, moral violence, and the poverty that surrounds them.
Vivem ao redor delas.
We can't win anymore. There's no ways we can win. The death toll is already too high, even in our country. But what we can do is we can mitigate the disaster. Because through mitigating the disaster, we can show our humanity. Beating HIV, HIV is going to be with us for a generation or more.
The numbers are staggering. 30 million people have already died. HIV has found its way into every country, into every stratum of society, even into the family of a president. Recently, Nelson Mandela's son died of AIDS.
When you think of it, that in, let's say, 25 years, roughly, that about 70 million people have become infected with this virus, probably coming from one at some point, it's mind-blowing. All these people are connected with each other by definition, because they had sex with each other, they shared needles, they got a blood transfusion from someone who got it, or their mother had it. That's it. There are no other ways of transmission. It's incredibly well adapted to us. It's a very, let's say, human virus, a very human epidemic. It touches right to the heart of our existence.
Do you have any questions you want to ask me?
Yes.
Why are you positive? Okay. You've got a virus in your blood. Okay, which makes you HIV positive. So that's why you're positive. Okay, you've got the virus. I don't know if your mom told you where she got the virus from. Did you explain to her? Okay, well one day when you're bigger she'll explain how you got the virus. But at the moment, if you take your medicine,
to watch that, like I said, that as you can see, it was being raised for a whole host of issues that we're talking about all summer, the HIV virus, the transmission, stigmatization of the HIV body and the HIV person, the possibility, or the elusive possibility, of there being a vaccine or a cure, and the current state that we're in, that I think that conversation with the child sort of demonstrates quite well, that
I don't want us to forget that today we're talking about chronicity, chronic illness, as AIDS is chronic illness, that we don't live in a world where people are dying, where there is poverty, and where there is a really tragic, urgent, sort of like fatal threat that AIDS happens. But we're simultaneously living in a world where there's the possibility, where, as that doctor said to that child, if you take your medicine, we can control the virus and you can live much longer. So it's in that moment of we have not resolved the problem of curing or alleviating the presence of AIDS in our culture or in our world, or the poverty that helps it expand exponentially so, but we are living in a world where we have something that can curtail the spread and perhaps extend the life of persons. And it's in that moment. It's a strange historical moment, actually. I mean, 20, 50 years from now, we may look back and think, remember that window between 95 and 2000 and fill in the rest of the blank? That's the moment we live in right now. And today is talking about how is it best for us to understand and to discuss persons with HIV, their legal protections, their cultural identity and cultural protections in that moment. So it's going to take a little bit of, ironically, sort of like contemporary perspective. You know, what is the moment we're living in historically and how is that complicated? To that end, I've decided that today's discussion is going to be about thinking about how do we understand persons with HIV then? Do we consider them as sick? Do we consider them as disabled? Do we consider them as normal? Do we make distinctions or not between HIV? When is it appropriate to? When is it disadvantageous to? Because I think that's kind of the terrain that we're sort of in right now, culturally. To that end, let's start with that piece from the Washington Post that I had you all read. Again, all of this predicated by having us watch that short clip from the documentary to see that the problems that we've had culturally, economically, politically, and epidemiologically related to HIV and AIDS are still with us. And yet, we have a moment where chronic is possible. And so it's shouldering those two things that we're talking about. So let's start with this piece that came out from the Washington Post, and I'm going to have us read it out loud in its entirety together. It's from 1998, and this is sort of the moment when the Supreme Court ruled that disability protection could be extended to all persons with HIV, regardless of whether or not you have actually progressed to having AIDS, or whether or not you're showing any symptoms or have any obvious manifestations of disability physically as we normally know it. This is about saying HIV in and of itself falls into the category of disability, and this moment that we're still sort of in is sort of going to provide the genesis of the conversation today. So I'm going to start by reading the first couple of paragraphs, and then you want to take it from me, and we'll just sort of work our way around the table and hopefully get done. And read as long as you want. If you want to do one paragraph or two or whatever, that's fine. So this is Disability Law Covers HIV Justices Rule from June 26, 1998. Americans with the AIDS virus won an important victory yesterday in their struggle for recognition, as the Supreme Court made clear for the first time that they are protected from discrimination under the nation's disabilities law from the moment they become infected. In a closely divided 5-4 decision, the court ruled that all people who are HIV positive, even those with no overt symptoms of the deadly disease, fall within the shelter of the Americans with Disabilities Act, the landmark federal law that prohibits discrimination in jobs, housing, medical care, and other places that serve the public. This decision represents the High Court's first ruling on an issue related to AIDS and its first major interpretation of the 1990s disabilities law. Influential as it may prove in the lives of people with HIV, the opinion could have even more far-reaching effect by broadening the grounds on which Americans may claim to be disabled, according to legal experts familiar with the case.
17 years into the AIDS epidemic in the United States, the decision on HIV, coming from a generally conservative court, is a striking mixture of compassion and precise clinical understanding about a disease that has often been highly stigmatizing. It reflects that this country has come a long way from moving from the simple fear of this disease to a more realistic understanding, said Chai Feldblum, a Georgetown University law professor who filed a brief on behalf of AIDS activists, gay rights advocates, and other civil rights organizations.
AIDS activists predicted yesterday that the decision involving a Maine woman whose dentist refused to fill her cavity unless she paid to have it done in a hospital could have a beneficial effect on public health. Some predicted, for example, that it could encourage more people to get tested for the disease, secure the knowledge that even if they do turn out to be HIV positive, they no longer risk losing their jobs, homes, or medical care. Some activists said the decision also may provide them greater leverage in trying to persuade the federal government to enable HIV-infected people to qualify for Medicaid, the government insurance program for the poor. Right now, only people with full-blown AIDS are covered. But if the definition of disability under that law were changed to include those who are simply HIV positive, It could enable more people to afford new classes of medications that can help many remain healthier for a longer period.
Between 400 and 650,000 Americans are infected with the human immunodeficiency virus, but are not sick enough to qualify as having AIDS, according to the most recent estimates of the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It is unclear how many of these people are symptom-free, the group directly affected by the court's ruling. Until now, lower courts have consistently held that Disabilities Act, that the Disabilities Act covered people with full-blown AIDS. As a result, coverage for that group was not in dispute. What the High Court did yesterday in Bragdon versus Abbott was establish that Sydney Abbott was covered too, even though she had no outward evidence of her infection. The ADA defines a disability as a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more of the major life activities of such individual. Justice Anthony M. Kennedy, who wrote the majority opinion, was pivotal to the case's outcome, siding with the court's four more liberal members. He said it was a misnomer to refer to HIV as asymptomatic even in its early stages. In light of the immediacy with which the virus begins to damage the infected person's white blood cells and the severity of the disease, Kennedy wrote, we hold it as an impairment from the moment of the infection.
Kennedy went on to say that Abbott's attorney, Bennett H. Klein, was correct in saying his client was impaired on the grounds she could not, in good conscience, reproduce because she may transmit the virus to a fetus. Reproduction and the sexual dynamics surrounding it are central to the life process itself, Kennedy said. Conception and childbirth are not impossible for an HIV victim, but without a doubt are dangerous to the public health. In deciding that reproduction is grounds for disability, and thus may not be discriminated against, the court may have made it easier for women to win insurance coverage for birth control or treatment for infertility, said Simon Heller, litigation director for New York's Bay Center for Reproductive Law and Policy.
It's anybody's guess how far employers can be pushed, said Anne Reisman, a spokeswoman for the Equal Employment Advisory Council, a group of 300 large businesses that sided with dentist Randon Bragdon in the case. She cited the recent example of a television station news anchor who had contended that she ought to be let out of broadcasts that conflicted with her fertility treatment. You can't exactly move the news, Reisman said. Bragdon, who refused to fill Abbott's cavity in his office in 1994, had argued that the ADA was intended to apply to impairments of more routine activities, such as one's ability to see, breathe, or walk.
Sure. John McCarthy, Bragdon's attorney, had also argued that his client could legally refuse to treat Abbott under a provision of the ADA that allows healthcare providers to turn patients away if treating them posed a risk to the doctor's health. The court said Bragdon must return to lower courts if he wants to prove he faced such a risk. The court's decision ratified the longstanding position of the Justice Department, which has regarded the AIDS virus, even among people without symptoms, as grounds for discrimination complaints under disability law. But relatively few people have pursued such cases. The Department's Civil Rights Office currently has 67 active cases involving discrimination complaints by HIV-infected people, 15 of them resembling Abbott's case in that they involve denial of health care services.
But despite the Justice Department's position, discrimination has persisted. In one recent instance, A. Bilowitz.
Sounds good.
A Wisconsin daycare center refused to accept a four-year-old boy who was HIV infected but had no symptoms. In other cases, a professor at Northeastern University in Boston went to court, contending that he had been denied tenure because he too was HIV positive. But by cementing that the ADA applies in such cases, yesterday's decision is the most important legal victory for people with HIV in the history of the epidemic, said Daniel Zingel, executive director of AIDS Action, a leading advocacy group.
Dissenting justice said that the person claimed of disability should be evaluated on an individual basis and that Abbott had not shown she was impaired in a major life activity. Chief Justice William H.
Ready for this?
Okay. Mm-hmm. Joined by Justice Anshin, Scalia, and Clarence Thomas, mm-hmm. said reproduction doesn't rise to the level of the major daily activities that Congress had intended to be included under the ADA.
Justice Sandra Day O'Connor wrote separately that the act of giving birth to a child, quite a very important part of the lives of many women, is not generally the same as the representative major life activities of all persons. But Georgetown Fairborn praised the majority, saying there is now a confluence of love and medicine that can be very powerful.
Okay. So let's start with this moment when this particular law was extended and why it was. What we're talking about here is, like I said, this idea that disability protections and even the label of disability itself can be applied to persons who are seropositive from the moment of contracting the virus, is what this article says. And the grounds for doing it at this particular moment was to think about, where's the phrasing in here, that the ADA defines disability as a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more of the major life activities of such individual. So to that end, semantically, trying to think whether one qualifies as disabled or not is to actually ask the question then, what is the impairment that we have here? And the debate is not about what people with full-blown AIDS would have been impaired by, because these are very sick individuals, so one can imagine a whole host of things with which they are impaired by: their vision, their health, their bowels, their mobility, their life course, how long they're going to live. I mean, there's a lot of things we can find. It's in persons who are otherwise appearing healthy and yet who are HIV positive that this law intervenes. Now, this is from 1998. This is maybe a handful of years after we really got the cocktail antiretroviral drugs in place, such that we're seeing a kind of chronic movement towards HIV. 12, 15 years later, what we have now here is that the majority of Americans who have HIV qualify under this. And this particular article, if you remember, the numbers it was talking about was saying, you know, so many million people have AIDS in the United States, only a small percentage qualify as having HIV but not AIDS, and probably an even smaller percentage in that group show no signs of having HIV, even though they have HIV and not AIDS. But the truth is that group is now the majority. The majority of people in the United States are people who have HIV, have it contained enough that they don't have full-blown AIDS, and probably don't show outward signs to the layperson that they have HIV. So to that degree, what we're talking about here is a decision that was made by a court for what was a very minor subset, but has now really determined, given the course of how antiretroviral treatments have worked in the United States, the status of most HIV persons in general and whether disability still applies. To that end, here's the conundrum. Disability, in its very sort of cultural sort of agency, is a lot like the term minority, in the sense that minority, as you know, speaking numerically, suggests that one is in the lesser quality number of people, you know. So there are fewer African Americans than there are non-African Americans. There are fewer immigrants than there are non-immigrants in the United States. There are fewer homosexual than there are heterosexual persons. That's technically, numerically, how we refer to minority. But you know, we have a cultural definition of minority too, which is to say we take the American sort of white heterosexual male sort of standard that we have and think anything not that falls into minority. We're in a strange impasse, to take one example, that in, I think it's going to be in the next 10 years or so in the United States, Hispanic Americans and Latin Americans are going to be in higher numbers than white Americans, and yet that label minority might still apply. I give you that little brush over to say that this is like that. This is talking about the use of disability as a category equivalent to like minority applied to a small subset of people who are seropositive in the late 1990s that now actually applies to the majority of people who have HIV. So it provides for us a case where is disability the appropriate term to use here. And what I want to set up for you, and we're going to look more closely at some of the things raised in this article, is this. Thinking about the term disability, how it's used, in a moment where we have chronic, and what we're asking is this. When is using the term disability advantageous or disadvantageous? When is it liberating? And when is it stigmatizing? So this is the dilemma. And I think we've kind of come to find that actually thinking about seropositivity as disability might shift and change in different circumstances and contexts. So in some cases, financially, it's quite advantageous to call oneself disability, one's HIV status a disability. Whereas in other instances, culturally, it's quite a disadvantage to think of oneself as being disabled. And it's that fluidity and that tension about whether or not to include or exclude disability and seropositivity together that we have this sort of dilemma. To that end, let me throw this out as a question to everybody. This particular case that we talked about here, the Supreme Court ruled on, thinking about the way in which a person's life activities could be curtailed, using the case of this woman who her lawyers argued was disabled because of the fact that it inhibited her right to have a child because of the fear of passing it on to her child. What do you make of that argument as a justification for disability according to the ADA's definition? Impairment that substantially limits one or more of the major life activities. How persuasive do you find that reason?
I think that's having a child if you want one as a major life activity. That seems pretty reasonable to me. Most people seem to have kids, so
yeah.
I don't know if that seems reasonable to me.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else?
Well, it does seem part of like the American dream or even a part of humanity to procreate and reproduce. So I guess it would fall in line with the two, I guess the way to describe it.
If we use that as a standard with which we can say a population is disabled, who else qualifies under that then, under the Disabilities Act?
Anybody that can't have kids.
Right? I think so, right? I think anybody who's infertile suddenly gets the American with Disabilities Act sort of protection. Mm-hmm. Is that extending it too far? Is not being able to have a child? So for example, we think quite often about the ADA as applying to workplace discrimination. So a woman is not hired for a job at a school because she has no children and that people really wanted to hire someone who was a teacher and a mom or what have you. It seems appropriate that person could then say, well, I can't have kids, so you can't deny me this job for that reason. Having said that, you know, it opens it in a lot of other ways too that makes it hard. I'll tell you, this is the hard part. This argument is not really used that much more because of the fact that we have very successful antiretroviral drug treatments that we can use that a seropositive woman can very easily have a child and not pass on HIV to that child if the proper medical care is taken. And if we're using as the crux of the defense that the ADA can apply to seropositivity, the fact that a mother can't give it to their child, two problems with that. What about the guys who are HIV positive then, one? And number two, if we now have a medication regime that can actually prevent this very problem, does that mean we've provided the toppling of the very justification for why the ADA applies? But it hasn't. The Americans with Disability Act still applies to people who are seropositive and HIV positive because it's still felt that from the moment of infection that one is seropositive, one has to some degree a disability. What are those disabilities then, would you say, if you can think about? Mm-hmm.
Financial, you know, you have to be able to afford your drugs.
Yeah, I think so. I think to knowing that the disease is chronic and incurable is to suggest that you've got a lifelong commitment to handling and managing this particular disease. So that is one of the very strong justifications that's used. And it's the same one that's used for people who have other chronic conditions too, like diabetes and such. People who have diabetes who don't have major severe symptoms, you know, they haven't lost a limb or had some crazy blood sugar problems, nevertheless know that they've got a condition that they have to manage and take care of for the rest of their lives. That is, which is to say, the Disability Act is meant quite often to protect anybody who has to manage their health in a special extended way for the rest of their life. So that's one justification. Any others? Financially, we said, is one.
I think just medically, physically, they're going to have more problems than someone who's not seropositive.
I think it's hard to make that threshold about when, if we all agree that there, and they're even saying at this moment, that there is some point that people with AIDS get to qualify as the Disability Act, where's that line then? You know, is it your T-cell count? Is it your weight combined to your body mass index?
Well, I think just having it, they're going to have more monitoring, even if they don't have, you know, symptoms or you're still going to have to stay on top of it more than any normal person.
And the thing about making it such that the Disability Act applies to all who are seropositive is that line is very easy to draw.
Right.
Are you positive or are you negative? Simple as that, you know? And the truth is, if you're positive, you may not have AIDS and you may not have outward symptoms, but you could, is this idea. So using the test itself as the marker with which we draw that line. Otherwise, what we have then is having to nickel and dime whether or not somebody has the right body mass index or the right T cell count or the right lesions or what have you. I know I've referenced this movie several times in this class, but you all have seen Philadelphia, the Tom Hanks movie. It purports to be a movie about AIDS and such, but really when it comes down to it, the genre it's in is like courtroom drama, you know, because that's what half the movie is. And the whole thing is it's a workplace discrimination suit. It takes place before this existed, and the whole movie is about should the guy have been fired. And the whole case, if you remember that movie, how many have seen the movie, by the way? Okay, the whole scene ends at the end, and Tom Hanks plays, you know, the guy, Andy Beckett, that, you know, they say, well, they didn't know you had AIDS, and how could they know you had AIDS, and there's no way to sort of discriminate or what have you. And the whole thing he has to prove in the courtroom is to show lesions on his body that look like the ones he had on his face at the time. Which is to say, it's an argument that suggests the protection of the right of a person who's seropositive only kicks in when it's obvious to the world that you have the disease. This is saying the opposite. This is saying by simply being a person who's living with a chronic and potentially fatal and incurable illness, you have the protections that the Americans with Disability Act has provided for you. To that end, one of the things that is an impairment that is still used to this day to justify the use of the ADA on HIV and AIDS is stigma and discrimination. You know, as much as we've come a long way in the way that we don't stigmatize AIDS the same ways, we do know that people can be easily stigmatized, not hired, shunned, ostracized for the illness. And it's that cultural impairment that in many ways has predicated the argument for keeping it. Yeah.
What you just said kind of reminds me, like this Kennedy quote stuck out to me. It's like, conception and childbirth are not impossible for an HIV victim, but without a doubt are dangerous to the public health. And it's like, in one breath, it's like, we'll refer to them as victims, but although either way, they're dangerous.
Yeah.
Like, so which one is it? It's like, it shows it a lack of, I don't know.
But it shows also the way in which it's almost inevitable that we have a hard time about standing up for people with HIV and then almost demonizing them in the next sentence, in the same way that we want to liberate and say empower people who have HIV, but then say you're disabled too. You know, so it's a hard thing to have both ways. To that end, this very question about disability isn't just one over chronicity, but it's also one about trying to think about how do we honor this particular sort of individual's identity. It's not just their health, but also the way we culturally sort of place them.
How does this apply to people, for example, with dyslexia? Like, there is no way to show physically any...
If you have dyslexia?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm pretty certain that dyslexia falls under the category of learning disabilities that people are absolutely protected by. And this is about sort of, let's actually turn to this document. This is the question and answers, the American with Disabilities Act, because I want to actually look at what are we talking about when we say the American with Disabilities Act and what it covers. In a minute, we're going to turn internationally to see what the other documents are. But persons with dyslexia or disabilities in the workplace, in the school environment, what have you, are guaranteed the services and rights to make sure that they can function to the same level as everybody else does. So, but having said that, it's one of those things with which one has to materialize or demonstrate or ask for those services. So for example, a person who is seropositive, who asks for the protections of the American Disabilities Act and is denied them, is absolutely being treated with an injustice. But the person who does not request those protections and does not let the other know that that very person is seropositive can be discriminated only so far as the ADA is invoked, so to speak. So a person who has hidden their dyslexia and not told anybody and not asked for it is only being violated if they have admitted or asked for services not been given to them. So this is what the ADA is standing for. Let's look at three questions that are on this particular sheet here. This is the first page. Does everybody have this one? Questions about, this is from the Department of Justice, so we're looking with the actual document here. The first page asks, are people living with HIV or AIDS protected by the ADA? And I'm just going to read a little bit of this. Yes, an individual has a disability under the ADA if he or she has a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more major life activities, including major bodily functions such as the functions of the immune system, has a record of such an impairment, or has an actual perceived mental or physical impairment that is not transitory and minor and is subjected to an action prohibited under the ADA. Persons with HIV, both symptomatic and asymptomatic, have physical impairments that substantially limit one or more major life activities or major bodily functions and are therefore protected by the law. persons who are discriminated against because they are regarded as having HIV are also protected. Does everybody understand that one? Persons who are discriminated against because they are regarded as having HIV. So, you know, I'm the gay guy in the office in some conservative place or what have you, and suddenly people aren't letting me use the washroom or something because they think everybody's got AIDS, gay or whatever, and I don't have it, but I am perceived to have it, falls under this too. So the cultural perception, not just the presence of the virus. For example, a person who was fired on the basis of a rumor that he had AIDS, even if he did not, would be protected by the law. Moreover, the ADA protects persons who are discriminated against because they have a known association or relationship with an individual who has HIV. For example, the ADA would protect a woman who does not have HIV who is denied a job because her roommate had AIDS, or her spouse, or her friend, or something like that. Or, I volunteered in AIDS shelter, but I can't get hired at the local hospital because they're worried about that. Can't do that sort of thing. It's the third of these categories. So people with HIV, people even suspected of having HIV, and people who are known to be in contact with HIV, that the third one doesn't just speak to the fear of the communicability of the disease, I think, but the way in which stigma can pass from not just with persons who have HIV, but people who've been associated to it, and that's what lingers in the policy. Let's look at a couple of examples here. This is on the second page under employment. What employment practices are covered by the ADA? The ADA prohibits discrimination in all employment practices. This includes not only hiring and firing, but job application procedures, including the job interview, job assignment, training, and promotions. It also includes wages, benefits, leave, and all other employment-related activities. Examples of employment discrimination against persons with HIV or AIDS would include, and let's just go through a few of these. An automobile manufacturing company that had a blanket policy of refusing to hire anyone with HIV and AIDS. I think we can take out automobile manufacturer and put almost anything in there and have that apply. An airline that extended an offer to a job applicant and then rescinded the offer after the employer discovered during the post-offer physical that the applicant had HIV. So this is speaking to the moment with which the application of the ADA applies. It's not your first day of work. It's from the minute you submit an application at any point. A restaurant that fired a waitress after learning that the waitress had HIV. A university that fired a physical education instructor after learning that the instructor's boyfriend had AIDS. A county tax assessment office that canceled training opportunities for an accountant following her disclosure that she had HIV. A retail store that generally rotated all sales associates between the sales floor, where they could earn more commissions, and the stock room, where they processed merchandise, except for the sales associate who was rumored to have HIV, who was never rotated to the floor. A call center employee who was denied a promotion to shift manager because his employer believed the employee would be unreliable since he has AIDS. And a company that contracted with an insurance company that had a cap on health insurance benefits provided, blah, blah, blah. This, the last one is the classic sort of like, I don't want anybody to know that I'm sick with anything when I go for a job interview because they're going to be afraid that I'm going to milk up all the insurance benefits I can get. So that can't apply here, is sort of the point. Any thoughts about these kinds of protections? And if you have any pause about any of them, it's pretty straightforward that it's about, at the level of this category, employment, the ADA is meant to really protect people in the status of their job.
I guess it's not what the practices that are covered, but why it has to be 15 or more employees. I feel like there's so many things like that, like all the insurance rules and stuff. Well, you have to have X number of employees to qualify.
Oh, for what? Like yeah, how big the company is or whatever like
yeah.
that? Yeah. Sometimes it has a lot to do with what constitutes a business, you know, a mom and pop shop, that kind of thing, you know. It also has a question to do with what constitutes an employee. I think it dovetails a lot with that. So, for example, a family that owns a family farm and has the kids that work on it,
yeah.
you know, they often think, well, very few families are more than 15. So this idea that, like, kids help out on family farms, it's a way of life. But if we suddenly call that a company, then suddenly they're breaking child labor laws left and right. So that number comes into play for those kinds of reasons. And I think it's only by sort of default that it sometimes applies here, okay. too, as well. Yeah. Anybody else? Questions about it? Yeah.
Isn't a lot of this, like, hard to prove?
It can be, yeah. I mean, but to be honest with you, discrimination lawsuits on any grounds are very hard to prove. Yeah. You know, it's very hard to find a direct correlation from A to B. And let's be frank, we do live in a world where there is discrimination that happens in all stages of work, you know. It's probably very true that there are many schools that would prefer to hire a mom than a non-mom in a certain role. School nurse or teacher or whatever. There are certainly places for any job, and we all know this too, where we go and we feel like, I don't want them to know I've got four kids that are under the age of four. You know, I'll just be, yeah, I have a couple kids, you know, that kind of thing, you know? Because the truth is, if you disclose that fact, they can't use it against you, but it's human nature that people will. And it's the difficulty in proving it that makes, even with protection, people are tend to be sort of guarded, if you will. Let's think then about what the function of this extension of the ADA is. It is absolutely to preserve these rights. You can't get fired, you can't get refused to be hired, you can't be denied access to services, and so on. But this little piece in the Washington Post had an allusion to what's an important part, which is to say the part of the reason of extending the American with Disabilities Act was really to make sure that it just gave one more reason why people wouldn't hesitate to get tested. So part of what's the function of the American Disabilities Act isn't about what happens in the workplace or in the schoolroom or in the hospital. It's how do we get more people to get tested? And if any of it has to do with the hesitation about their boss knowing or their teacher knowing or whatever, let's just take that out of the way. So that even if we still got all the problems with being able to prove the discrimination in those places, we got them to get tested earlier than they could. So in some ways, the function of the American with Disabilities Act isn't professional, isn't financial, isn't cultural, it's epidemiological. It's how do we make sure that people aren't afraid to access services. Yeah.
This last thing that references health insurance, how was this treated between the passing of this ADA Act and like pre-existing conditions, things like that?
Yeah.
So the first disclosure to an insurance company, are you always then marked as having HIV? And like how
and before this?
Yeah.
I think it was not unlike other illnesses in that regard, yeah.
So it would kind of be like a stamp on your medical record that you had this, and then every future company that you ever worked for a job would know, right?
This is also a period, though, where we're having a lot of tension, and this is why there was the allusion to Medicaid in this piece, too, about what gets covered under what condition. So what is considered an opportunistic infection related to HIV, and what is an unrelated sort of thing that's covered? It is, if the AIDS is going to be covered under insurance, absolutely, then can't everything eventually fall under that umbrella, too, with a chronic illness? So it's negotiated to the point where I would say that I can say with good confidence that at that time the standard would not have been universal from insurance company to insurance company. And the ADA is an attempt to try to normalize across insurance providers. But the point of it is also that it's happening in the government's own house. Even within Medicare and Medicaid, they were having a hard time about figuring out how much covers and what applies to what. So to that degree, as I said, part of the reason that this policy passed about seropositivity from its first inception being cause for disability was to make that line in the sand very obvious, who gets covered, who doesn't. It was also to an attempt to try to at least level off the widely different senses of coverage that were sort of provided health insurance-wise. And it's no fault to the big bad insurance company or the big bad government here. It's to say that this is in period, and when we're still kind of living in, where fatality is still a reality connected to AIDS, but chronicity and long-term survival also is. And it's hard to negotiate those two particular things. One of the worries, of course, about extending the American with Disabilities Act here, too, is the fact that if we can extend it to all persons with HIV, not just those who are really sick, then what we are having to do then is say Medicaid for all HIV services applies for anybody at any point if they need it below a certain economic level, as opposed to just when you get really sick. The worry is that we're going to overtax, and I don't mean tax like taxes, but overpressure the Medicaid and services industry. So that if we extend how long you're disabled, then we're extending how much access you have to services and such. And it's the worry economically about that that sort of provided some of the pushback here too. So it's a negotiating moment. And I think the point of today's class is it may seem like we're past this problem, but we're still, I think, negotiating it. Yeah.
I just had a quick question as far as what's the general, I guess, average survival for if you're on, you know, good drugs and you stay on your drugs?
Like, yeah.
What's the general, I guess, because it said in the video it was like 8 years in Brazil.
That was
a while ago.
10 years ago,
I think.
I
didn't know if you knew or off the top of your head.
Yeah. It varies depending upon economic class, age, and pre-existing conditions, assuming that we're assuming the same quality of care for persons. But I think now the average is 20 plus with the best care. So, and that's a conservative number, to be honest with you. So, yeah. But if we take the best conditions, healthy before you were, non-smoker, your, you know, cholesterol rate and other conditions are in place, and you've got the best meds and are diligent about taking them on time and so on, there's no end number that's sort of provided there, you know. There is still the statement that was put out by the CDC and NIH, though, nevertheless, you will still someday die with or of this disease. But having said that, we can't determine what your extent of your life would be. That's in the best of circumstances.
Mm-hmm. I think in the last international conference a couple of weeks ago, the estimate was 30 years.
Yeah. And that's why I said 20 was very conservative.
Yeah, 30 years.
And that has less to do with the fact that it stops working after 30 years. But if we start to average out when certain people got infected, and let's say the average age is 37, well, 67. Well, 67 is getting real close to what just the non-HIV positive sort of age line is. Yeah. So it's that sort of thing.
In fact, there were presentations concerning what to do with the aging population with HIV.
Yeah. In fact, if any of you are interested in this, this is a really hot topic, I mean, to think about, because it's brand new, and not new in the real sense, but what to think about the aging HIV-positive population, but also the aging queer population, too. There was, I did a talk, like a year ago or someplace, for a bioethics conference, and it was all about stages of life for LGBT persons in bioethics, and I did it on old age, and what I did was shared with the audience a whole host of examples from famous novels and films that were gay novels and films in the 1970s, and they all had scenes that were kind of funny scenes where here's a moment where people, the first generation of gay people who post-Stonewall are liberated and out of the closet, you know, are also making jokes about, you know what, in about 20 years we're going to need a retirement home, aren't we? And there's a great joke in Tales of the City by Armistead Maupin. He wrote this famous gay series about San Francisco where the people are like, oh my god, we could have a gay retirement home, and we could have like rodeo roundups, and we could have like denim colostomy bags, and like, you know, they're trying to be like funny about all of it, right? And the thing about it is this kind of conversation appears in many cultural moments in the 1970s, and then AIDS comes along, maybe less than a decade later, and those very people and those very characters in some of those books don't live past 40 or 50 or 60 or what have you. So what we see is that the potential for a retiree age group, even within the queer population, sort of disappeared in a major significant way for a time. But we are now in a moment where, and here we are again. And so I did this talk, and the last thing I ended that talk on was, and let me show you where we are now. And I gave them a tour of like the 10 gay and lesbian retirement homes that exist in the United States now, with the brochures and the tour, and there was the pool and the jacuzzi and that kind of thing, you know? So, but I mean, this is what we're doing with seropositivity too. This idea that thinking about what is the extended age life of seropositivity, it wasn't a possibility to even think about it that way. And now it certainly is, yeah.
So, but what's the idea with that? Is it to have like HIV, AIDS, like almost like palliative care facilities where like later in life there was like specialized treatment, like we deal with this all the time, so like we know what it's like with that?
I think it can be a couple of things. Part of it can be palliative care related. Part of it can be about making sure that HIV treatment is in the fold of geriatric medicine rather than a supplement or a satellite of it. And it's also to in some ways normalize, I think, the idea that one can be old and one can have HIV. For so long we out of necessity had to see that to have HIV was to say you are probably already thinking about your funeral or about how your days are numbered or something, and we don't have to say that anymore. So when we get to the point of just human existence, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, where people are thinking about retiring or you know, end of life sort of concerns, to think about HIV persons as a part of that conversation. It's this conversation. HIV, because of its fatality rate in the first years, necessitated that everybody who had the disease immediately had to think about, I might die. With the rise of chronicity, we embraced, encouraged HIV persons to say, you are going to live. Hence, we moved from the phrase dying of AIDS to living with AIDS, was sort of semantically how we did. And yet, people with HIV and AIDS are human beings and they're going to die someday. So how do we comfortably return them to the conversation of thinking about dying, but in a way very different than we have had historically 10, 15, 20 years ago? That's sort of the dilemma that's happening there. It's a touchy concern, but one that has a whole host of practical and cultural sort of imperatives. Any other questions about this stuff? Let's look at another example here. Let's turn to the next page. Take a look if you have a chance at the second page, with the next page, page 3, what is a reasonable accommodation? A lot of what the Americans with Disabilities Act is about isn't just about you can't get fired, you have a chance to get hired, that kind of thing, you can't be denied this, but how do employers, businesses, schools, jurisdictions accommodate people with disabilities? The American with Disabilities Act, when it first came about in 1990, really was an attempt to formalize in a very significant federal way things like traditional disabilities of, we need to have Braille signage in all public buildings. There needs to be at least one handicap access or ramp or whatever in certain buildings for at all places, public and private, that kind of thing. There were plenty of laws on the books in different jurisdictions and different places and according to different standards. But the American with Disabilities Act, when it came out in the early 1990s, was an attempt to universalize across the country what those standards would be for people with significant physical and mental impairments. It's in the late 90s where we started to negotiate other things. So that pregnancy example is a good one that we had in that article, because it's in the mid to late 90s that we're starting to see how pregnancy isn't a disability in the same sense of its physical long-termness. But having said that, a woman can't be fired from a job because she gets pregnant, or she can't be denied an interview because they can tell that she's pregnant or whatever, something like that. It falls under the Disabilities Act for very similar cultural sort of reasons that HIV and AIDS do. Let's turn to a different section in here. That was on employment. Let's look at page 7 under public accommodations. And I'm just doing this to give us a sense, because the examples are kind of good in here to have us think about different ways that this ADA thing applies. What constitutes discrimination on page 7? Discrimination is the failure to give a person with a disability the equal opportunity to use or enjoy the public accommodations, goods, services, or facilities. Examples of ADA violations would include a dentist who categorically refused to treat all persons with HIV or AIDS. Sounds familiar. A moving company that refused to move the belongings of a person who had AIDS, or that refused to move the belongings of a person whose neighbor had AIDS. A health club that charged extra fees to persons who had HIV, or that prohibited members with HIV from using the steam room or sauna, or that limited the hours during which members with HIV could use the club's facilities. A daycare center that categorically refused admission to children with HIV or the children of mothers with HIV. A funeral home that refused to provide funeral services for a person who died from AIDS-related complications. And let's just say the Disabilities Act, its protections extend even after you've passed away. A building owner who refused to lease space to a not-for-profit organization that provided services to persons with HIV or AIDS. A cosmetology school that refused to enroll a student once they learned that she had HIV. An overnight summer camp where children sleep in group cabins that requires a camper with HIV to sleep in the camp infirmary. There's a big brouhaha right now, if you don't know, I guess it was a couple months ago, in Hershey, Pennsylvania. There's the Hershey like Boys Academy or something like that. It's a private school, residential, what have you, founded by the Hershey family. They refused admission to a kid because he was HIV positive. Now, this is a privately owned organization, but nevertheless, it's a place that's accredited by the state for education, so there is actually a big court dispute happening right now about whether they can legally allowed to do that. I mention that because it's from just weeks ago. So while the extension of the ADA took place 12, 14 years ago, its very contentious implementation still exists sort of to this day. And I think it is because of the fact that we're still living in that historical moment where fatality is a reality. Chronicity and a long life is a reality too. And how do you justify and acknowledge both of those simultaneously? Any questions about this section on what constitutes discrimination? Okay, let's turn really quickly then to this piece I'm going to hand to you. Whoa. This is from the Human Rights Watch. Go.
What is interesting is how the big corporation managed to get over this with great excuses, great lawyers,
company. How they were able to get around it for a while. Yeah. I mean, it's because it's hard to prove, you know? Let's look at the couple of examples. What this is basically is international laws that apply towards disability in general. This is called HIV and disability, but I'll give you an example of what it's trying to talk about here. Let's look at the little example on the side that's in italics from this quote from Winston Zulu. There's a tuberculosis, a TB and HIV AIDS activist from Zambia. If you have a wheelchair and you go to an AIDS service organization and the first thing you see are all these flights of stairs, you are immediately discouraged. Secondly, HIV testing and counseling services are supposed to be confidential, but if you're deaf and you go into this service, you have to go with someone who can interpret for you, which takes away the confidentiality part. So in the end, people don't turn up. Turning the page, and we'll get back to that example in a moment, these are the four sort of major international bodies that provide senses of disability protection internationally. The Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, CRPD, the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and then, of course, the Convention on the Rights of Children. And these are subsets that are advocated by the Human Rights Watch in connection with the World Bank and the World Health Organization. So what these basically provide are the ways in which discrimination is not supposed to happen internationally on the basis of disability. And what this little document is providing for us is that the international justifications that support and defend the rights of persons who are HIV tend to understand not the HIV itself as the disability, but when there is either correlated or not correlated a disability accompanying that HIV. So, and that's the example we had here of, I want to get tested, but I'm in a wheelchair, or I have HIV, but I'm also deaf. So internationally, the most protections take place when HIV is in combination with disability, whereas in the United States, HIV itself is the disability, and that's just kind of the distinction I wanted to drive home there. And that takes place for many different reasons, in the sense that that sense of chronicity that we have attached to HIV and AIDS, as we saw from the documentary we looked at earlier, doesn't always apply to every place in the world, in particular places that are impoverished or have poor infrastructure or don't have access to drugs. So to be HIV positive is probably to show outward signs of disability and illness and sickness in many places in the world. So it's in some ways that, ironically, the idea of clinical progress and an extended lifespan necessitates the need to make HIV a disability rather than vice versa. Thus, untreated, HIV looks more like disability. But if you treat HIV, it doesn't look like disability, and thus all the more reason we need to call it disability is sort of the dilemma that we have here. Does that make sense to everybody? Yeah, okay. Any questions about this international policy sort of stuff here? Again, it's just trying to show that while we have a global blanket sort of protection domestically in the United States, internationally, governing bodies tend to think of HIV in combination with disability, or HIV that looks like disability in a serious sort of way.
Yeah. When thinking about the United States ban and people who had HIV to come to the country, wasn't that a violation of the ADA?
Except that in those cases, they weren't American citizens or residents or in the country that yet. So the policy about making sure people couldn't come to the United States, you know, was protecting people who are here in the country. It seems like a weird sort of contradiction, you know?
Yeah.
And that's sort of the point, is the fact that the ADA, as much as it protects certain specific professional, cultural, service, health-related rights to some degrees, also has its limitations too. And that's kind of why last week, the last thing I had us look at was that thing where Obama said, like, we got to get rid of this thing. And,
yeah.
And his getting rid of it had a lot to do with the fact that we're not fully implementing the Disabilities Act as far as we can, if we're using this.
And also the conference to come to the United States.
Yeah.
The international conference was because President Obama.
Yeah, the International AIDS Conference,
yeah,
before that ban was lifted, was always held abroad,
yeah,
for that very reason, you know.
Yeah.
Let's turn lastly towards this article that I had to read that says PMLA on the front, the one that's about disability studies. Does everybody know what disability studies is? If you're familiar with it, it's a field of study in the sciences and the social sciences and the humanities that really came to rise in prominence in the 1990s or so. It came to prominence around the same time as queer theory came to prominence. I'll give you two parallel examples. If queer theory or queer studies seems to be it's about the study of lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender persons, it is that. But it's a second thing too. It's how do we look at the world through a lens that can be queer in some way. In other words, queer is both a noun and a verb. Let's look at queer people and queer identities and queer cultures, but let's think about how we would queer the world, and how is that difficult inhabiting or thinking about a world in which there are normative and non-normative sort of standards when it comes to sexuality, and how that complicates things. Disability studies is like that too. It's a noun and a verb too in some sense. As a noun, it's looking at the lives, the identities, the bodies, the composition, the cultural discourses about people who are blind, deaf, handicapped, disabled, learning impaired, mentally impaired, etc., etc. But it's also about thinking about, what does it mean to call somebody disabled? Who gets to count under that category? Is that a label I want to be liberated from, or one I want to groove inside of? Is it one that I want to see get as big as possible to include lots of people, or do I want to keep it limited in some way? What's the sense of solidarity? Is it a label that I want to be able to use in some places but not in others? AIDS is a very interesting topic in the sense that it really perfectly straddles disability studies and queer studies, because it's operating when these fields are coming into prominence. And these fields are coming into prominence because we're in a world where we're trying to question what's the right label to give something. My point about this is I want to turn to this little article by Robert McCrory, because what's happening in practice, in policy and in law, in attaching AIDS to the term disability, is also what's happening theoretically and culturally and intellectually in our culture today, to try to think about whether AIDS and disability are sort of terms that can cohabitate. So what I want to do is sort of look at a couple of moments in this text that sort of provide for us, what does it mean to think about disability as a category that can empower and a category that can sometimes disempower or stigmatize? And how is that another thing to just add to the complications of thinking about the American with Disabilities Act applying to seropositivity? I'm going to start by reading the first paragraph that's on the first page here. And it reads this. In Seeing the Disabled, Visual Rhetorics of Disability in Popular Photography, Rosemary Garland Thompson argues that representations of disability in photography over more than a century have generally fallen into four broad categories. So the images of people who are disabled for her fall in four categories. One, the wondrous, which places the disabled subject on high and elicits awe from viewers because of the supposedly amazing achievement represented. One can think of, I forget his name, the South African runner who's in the Olympics right now. Have you seen he was running yesterday and the day before, who has double amputee but has those bowed legs? Yeah. Wondrous. The sentimental, which places the disabled subject in a diminished, childlike, or custodial position, evoking pity. So the desolate-looking person who is either disabled or impoverished or sick. The exotic, which makes disability strange and distant, a freakish or perhaps transgressive spectacle. So the circus freak show we can think of, or the sideshow, or the way in which we think of, you know, TV specials, you know, the amazing octopus woman or some shit like that, you know, this that kind of exaggeration. And lastly, the realistic, which brings disability close, potentially minimizing the difference between viewer and viewed. In the essay, which first appeared in print in the important Disability Studies anthology, Garland Thompson reiterates some of the central disability studies insights that have transformed scholarship in the humanities over the past decade. Simultaneously, she takes disability studies in new directions, blah, 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 blah. We talked about the AIDS body and viewing the AIDS body probably about a month and a half ago, if I remember, when I had us talk about Foucault and this clinical gaze, and that the act of looking at, representing, and even studying a person who's seropositive is itself a bioethically fraught and problematic thing. So too with disability studies. I mentioned Rosemary Garland Thompson's name to you that week because I told you that she wrote a very famous essay just after this one on steering.
Oh, we can, I cannot see with that.
No. Nope.
I'm sorry.
How about now?
Yes. Thank you.
Sure. On steering. So this idea that we're told with those who are sick and those who are disabled in particular, when we're kids even, you know, don't stare, don't look at them or what have you. And the idea being we don't want to objectify them or make them feel odd. But Garland Thompson's point is that the act of telling us not to stare at people also has the potential to render them invisible, not worthy of being looked at the same time. It's an enduring problem in culture, which is to say, do I look at you and make you feel like you're a weirdo? Or do I not look at you and make you feel like you're not worth my time? You can't. You have to do one or the other. You know what I mean? So it's being aware of that dilemma. That's what's happening here about disability studies too. And that's the rubric under which we think about seropositivity at the same time. To stare, to label as disabled, to include or exclude under a provision like the ADA, is that the equivalent of gawking at, or is it the equivalent of ignoring in some degree? And it's that problem that sort of represents sort of what we're dealing with right now. To that end, turn to page 587, just turn the page. The left-hand column refers to this study by Mikhail Berube, who writes in his afterword to disability studies, that disability studies will be widely understood as one of the normal but not normalizing aspects of the study in the humanities. I want to sort of linger on that phrase for a second because I think it really is the dilemma we're talking about here. Normal but not normalizing. Somebody want to paraphrase for me what you think that means? Or how would you make the distinction between what is normal and what is normalizing?
I guess like to say that something is, for instance, disability studies is normal but not normalizing, I guess it's saying that it's becoming more commonplace and more necessary, mm-hmm. but it's also making evident more, like, it's making more evident differences among, like, disabled and not disabled people.
Yeah, I think that's a good distinction to make. It's this idea about wanting to take away the stigma, but not wanting to take away the identity itself. So, for example, some people say, and they want to live in a post-racial world, you know, oh, I don't see color, I don't see black or white or what have you, you know, and this is supposed to be a great moment of sort of like acceptance because I don't distinguish anymore or what have you. But what you've also taken away with that logic is, well, how about representing and accepting my culture or who I am or what is important to me? I want you to stop stigmatizing me, but I don't want you to ignore a human part about me in order for that to happen. To be normal but not normalizing is sort of to have that kind of philosophy too. How do we make it such that disability or seropositivity or queerness are things that we don't judge as abnormal in a sort of freakish sort of bad way? But we also can understand that we're not normalizing them at the degree that we're whitewashing them or getting rid of them. That's sort of the tension that we have here. And this is the thing about with disability studies that we sort of have. To think about disability as a category that's not about being abnormal in the subpar sort of sense, but still preserving the part that it's still special. It still has its own sort of special needs in some way. And including seropositivity under that rubric or that umbrella of disability is the dilemma that we're talking about here too. Let's think for a minute about a couple of examples about where it would be, where would you find a seropositive person having an affront to saying, don't call me disabled? Where would, under what context could you see that happening?
I guess they just want to be viewed as normal, like everyone else,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Capable.
Yeah, exactly, yeah, that's what I mean. Mm-hmm. Or like capable, like there's not things they can't do.
Right.
Because of their...
Right. Which is to say that I don't want to think about my life as truncated, mm-hmm. having to be cut off or less than. I'm not talking about how many years you live, but how full of a life I can have. And the problem with that the disability provides that suggestion, or that we need to strip that suggestion from the category of disability. My point is a little bit of this. It's that the affront that a lot of persons with seropositivity have towards being called disabled isn't those things that disability implies. It's the fact that we maybe shouldn't be applying them to disability at all. It's part of the reason why the very term disability is itself sort of currently up for debate. Is that the right term we should be using? Disabled, you know, unable, that sort of thing. And to that degree, thus, we saw this happening a lot in the 90s too, didn't we? When we had things like, I'm not short, I'm height challenged, or stuff like that. You know, people trying to find the most PC sort of like term or what have you. But it's about this way in which we need to preserve the category, but we need to get the name right and try to make sure that it's not endowed with the stigma that comes with it. I provide this setup because of the fact that as we can see from the documents we looked at with the American with Disabilities, there are practical, real, legal, financial, and even epidemiological, when I talked about the example of getting more tested, reasons to apply a term like disability towards HIV. And yet, there's this whole cultural normal but not normalizing sort of dilemma that makes us have pause about doing that. It's in the face of this theoretical and cultural concern, but this very practical epidemiological necessity that gives us what is the bioethical dilemma about attaching HIV and AIDS to disability. Any questions? I want to end by looking at the last piece on here, but yeah, go ahead, Celia.
It's similar to the argument about handicapped and disabled.
Yeah, that's right. And thus the term handicapped has started to follow. I think we still see it sometimes on parking signs, don't we? Don't I feel like it's still there? Yeah, yeah. And that may just be because of the fact that they're so pervasive all over the place, it would take forever to replace them all. But handicapped quite often does not get used in particular documentation, or for that very reason, you know. Mm-hmm. And to be honest with you, this is a cultural sort of like endurance that's going to happen, so to speak, always negotiating and renegotiating what are the right labels that we use. My point is simply that in the case of attaching disability to AIDS, we're not just dealing with a cultural kind of byproduct, but we actually have legal and epidemiological sort of effects that come with it. So I'm going to read the end of this article because I think it kind of talks about what is another concern that we sort of have when it comes to disability, including HIV, persons with HIV and AIDS. And it's the concern that was raised in that first article we looked at attached to the topic. If seropositivity, even when one is healthy, gets to fall under the umbrella of disability and all of the services and protections that come with that, then potentially we could live in a world where everybody falls under that umbrella for some different cultural or biological or sort of physical sort of psychosomatic sort of reason. And this paragraph sort of speaks to that. This is on page 591, the right-hand column. I'm going to be reading the penultimate and the last paragraph. Rewriting a disability studies truism helps me bring these points home. Sooner or later, if we live long enough, so we often say, we will all become disabled. Another twist on that, on the truism, is that disability is the one identity that each of us will, at some point in our lives, inhabit. I'm going to pause there for a second, which is to say, because we all die, we are all going to, at some point, probably be in a position where we ourselves might be disabled. I'll give you an example. One of the places that has some of the worst disability coverage when it comes to health insurance, hearing impaired deafness. And the reason being is that in old age, everybody loses their hearing if you reach a certain age. So the idea that we can provide a certain amount of testing or hear, I should know, my dad's 80% deaf in both ears and has been since he was a little boy. And we've always had a problem with when he gets hearing aids or even has to get hearing aid batteries or go whatever. Rarely get any of it covered. And the reason being is that once we start covering hearing on a large scale for people, suddenly that means everybody over 65, you know, and that's going to be this huge cost. Mm-hmm. So the point of that example is not to talk about the insurance, but it's to talk about the fact that what Robert McCrew is saying is here, that if we know that deafness is one example, or hearing loss of disability, and most people who live to be over 65 or 70 are going to have hearing loss, then everyone's going to be disabled in some degree. And that's just one example of probably thousands we could have right here. So I just wanted to mention that here as I continue. I don't want to dispute these foundational disability studies points as long as we endure systems of oppression like compulsory able-bodiedness, which have generally prohibited people with disabilities from becoming subjects because it was assumed they could not exert themselves on capital's behalf. They are worth emphasizing, but I do want to invert them. Sooner or later, if we live long enough, we will all become normate. Normate is the term that we use in the opposite of minority, normate.
Normate.
You know, queer, normate, disabled, normate. But just another word for saying the normal that we tend to talk about. So if one day we're all going to be disabled, then we could say at some point in our lives we're all going to be normal at some point. And if the established disability studies point is worth repeating again and again, the queer disability studies point I'm excavating is worth resisting, especially as disability studies becomes, rightly and desirably, one of the normal aspects of study in the humanities. The fact that if we live long enough, all of us will become normate is arguably the dominant story of the gay movement at the turn of the century. Resistance to becoming normate, consequently, has over the last decade engendered some of the most critically queer work around, from gay shame counter festivals in New York and San Francisco. I've mentioned this to you this semester, you know what gay shame movement is? It's, if gay progress has been a lot based on pride, gay pride, gay pride, gay pride, there's a point where queer culture in the last 15, 20 years has said, let's try to think of another emotion besides just pride to work with, and let me actually embrace feelings of abjection, not just feelings of conquer, if you will. So he mentions that example about gay shame, or that the fact that gay pride is now brought to you by Budweiser, he says here, to queer theory, that relentlessly draws our attention to the ways in which our most vital public cultures are being circumscribed or privatized out of existence. It may be impossible to say right now that someday soon that circumcision will cease. It's hard to deny the bleakness of the world we currently inhabit. But keeping a crip eye on the horizon, we should nonetheless continue to demand access to a world shaped otherwise. The point of this and what's trying to say is that as we attempt to render normal but not normalizing the identities like disability and seropositivity, what we're trying to do is be realistic about what it is to live with a person who lives with HIV, what it is to be a queer person or a minority or a poor person in our culture, or a disabled person in our culture. But we're also trying to make sure that that realism does not deny the absolute place that certain persons inhabit in our culture and our society. In some ways, it's the conversation in disability studies or queer studies about saying, let's make sure that we get the rights and protections and services, but let's not sell out too much. It's a difficult position of saying, I hate being a marginalized population, whether because of race, class, gender, sexuality, gender identity, disability. I hate being put on the margins. But at the same time, I like being counterculture and knowing that I'm not normal at the same time. So how do I make sure that I have the same mobility and rights and protections as everybody else, but also don't give in to the man, so to speak, and not forget that I am different. I am seropositive. I am disabled. I am queer or something like that. That personal negotiation with the label of disability has its parallel in the cultural and institutional hesitation we have about attaching disability as well. My point is that I think there is this clinging and pushing away and clinging and pushing away that happens with labels like disability. And I mention it because, like I said, we're in that moment. We're in that moment where, when we are older, hopefully we will look back and say, remember back in 2012, and I was taking that class, and it was all about the disability protections and the chronic, because everybody was, if you got HIV, you were going to die with HIV. But people would live a long life. That was a weird moment, those 15, 20, 30, hopefully years is what we will say. And this is the perfect symptom of that negotiation. And I think it's going to continue to be sort of negotiated in the years to come until we can be arrested and freed a bit from the idea that, you know, we're not in a world that isn't necessarily fatal HIV, but there's no vaccine. There is a chronic possibility, but yet there's a way in which everybody dies of the disease. That straddling, I think, is the struggle we have right now. And hopefully looking at the movie a bit today, if you remember the portions we saw the first day and the first things we talked about with the illness show that AIDS has not only become more hopeful in its progress, but it's also become more complex in the ways that it bioethically interacts with the world. Any questions? Anybody? Yeah.
The queer theory, is that just American or is
No, it's international. It's international. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And is people feel comfortable to using the term queer?
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, and the idea,
so it's no offensive.
No, and that's the point. The point is to say, let's think about embracing not just the pride we have in our identity, but also the painful history that comes with it too. So let's take a slur like that word queer and let's reappropriate it. At the same time, African-American culture and a lot of its pop culture reappropriated the N-word and used it different ways in specific contexts. Mm-hmm. Disability is about doing that same thing too. Do I want people not to call me disabled anymore, or do I want to say, yeah, fuck yeah, I'm disabled, I wear that with pride? That's sort of the point. And I think it's that contextually, historically, and under different circumstances, when we do or don't want to use a label, has a lot of weight. And not just ethically, but as we can see practically from the services that it provides. AIDS just happens to be this perfect epidemiological example that negotiates the sexual, political, economic, and epidemiological politics that apply to all of these different categories. Thank you, everybody, for a great semester. You know where to find me if you have questions about paper. They're just due in like in a week from now. If you need a little extra time, not a problem. Just give me a heads up so I don't know. I know to submit an incomplete or something for you. What I'm going to have everybody do right now is fill out the evaluations. So it's mostly just a couple numbers to circle, and if you want to write something nice in the bottom, that's good too. And when you're done, if you can stick this in the envelope, I am going to leave the room and come back and get them. And like I said, Dora's reception is going to be in about 20 minutes. So down the hall. So I've got plenty of time to fill this out if you want to take your time. And thanks so much, everybody. I appreciate this.
Thank you. Can I save some of the handouts for Renata and Hussein?
Oh, they're in the middle right there.
Okay.
Yep, no problem.